Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 28th, 2024. I am your reader, Sharon Faldudo, on a rainy Sunday in Coralville. From the front page of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette, Google Data Center would thirst for CR water. City may have to dig more wells for proposed $576 million project by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. In Cedar Rapids, where leaders have approved tax breaks for a proposed Google data center, the top 10 largest water users together now use about 60% of the city's average daily treated water. If Google comes to town, the share of treated drinking water going to big customers, including ethanol plants, food processors, and the data center, could increase to 70% or more, given estimates city leaders provided the Gazette. The city has surplus water capacity, rarely needed except for the hottest weeks of summer, and could drill more wells along the Cedar River to increase the supply. Other Iowa communities with large-scale data centers are planning infrastructure upgrades to pull more water from rivers and aquifers. There's no question these facilities use a significant amount of water, Cedar Rapids City Manager Jeff Pomerant said about data centers when he spoke this month to the Gazette's editorial board. When we have a new economic development project, one of the first things we look at is, can we serve it? And if we can't at this moment or can't 3 years from now, what are the improvements that need to be made in order to provide for that need? As Google considers whether to build the $576 million data center north of the Eastern Iowa Airport, residents wonder how much water and electricity a data center would use and whether the project would raise residents' rates or deplete the drinking water supply during a drought. As long as we get our normal rainfall, I'm sure there's enough water in the Cedar River and Cedar River alluvium to support a data center, state geologist Keith Schilling said. It's the droughts we've got to worry about and possibly the capacity of the current city wells to come up with that extra volume. Data centers are fortified warehouses where tech firms house linked computer servers and other hardware that support the applications we use and data we store online. All of us have pictures in the cloud, documents in the cloud, and increasingly we're accessing artificial intelligence, said Jim Martin Schramm, a policy analyst for Clean Energy Districts of Iowa, a nonprofit that focuses on renewable energy and local ownership. I don't think people really grasp how the convenience of cloud-based computing is linked to massive amount of energy consumption. Iowa has at least 26 data centers, but only a few are as large as what Google is proposing in Cedar Rapids. Besides a Google site in Council Bluffs, Meta has a complex in Altoona, Apple is building in Waukee, and Microsoft has 6 buildings in West Des Moines. Data centers use a lot of energy to run computer equipment, plus redundant systems, and to cool the equipment so it can continuously work at a high level. Nobody wants Facebook to go down when they're uploading vacation photos, or for Google to not return search results for the prompt, "Why do data centers use so much energy?" Google and Alliant Energy are negotiating a deal on one or more data centers in the Big Cedar Industrial Center along 76th Avenue Southwest and Edgewood Road Southwest. The state has approved the city's plan to grant $56 million in tax breaks in the form of a 20-year 70% tax exemption. Google would be required to create at least 31 high-paying jobs. Cedar Rapids leaders trumpeted the project for the future tax benefits and the way Google's presence in the corridor might spur other growth. Google already has invested over $5 billion in its Council Bluffs data center campus, the Des Moines Register reported. Because Google hasn't decided yet whether to build in Cedar Rapids, the company declined to provide specific information about projected water and energy use. Alliant and city leaders are also being cautious. "These things are extremely hard to get done," Pomerant said, "and some fall apart very quickly." The water-guzzling habits of data centers are in the spotlight worldwide, with a 2021 article in the journal NPJ Clean Water reporting a medium-sized center uses as much water as 3 average-sized hospitals or more than 2 18-hole golf courses. Tech firms use the water to cool computer servers to reduce the chance of equipment failures. More than half the water center data use is treated drinking water, the article noted, which companies want because it doesn't have minerals and other contaminants that might degrade chillers and cooling towers. Google says it's the only major cloud provider to provide our annual site-level data center water consumption. Its 2023 report showed the firm's Council Bluffs data centers use more water than any other Google data center in the nation, SiliconANGLE reported. "We take a climate-conscious approach to data center cooling decisions," Google said in a statement sent to the Gazette. The company evaluates hyperlocal hydrology to find the most effective cooling solution for each campus, whether that is air cooling, water cooling, refrigerants, or a combination. A Google data center in Cedar Rapids would be among the city's largest water users. The city's number one water customer uses an average 11.7 million gallons of water a day, more than three times the volume of the next highest, which uses 3.3 million gallons of water a day on average. Cedar Rapids would not provide names for these large industrial water users, but a 2010 Gazette article said corn processing giant ADM was the city's largest water user by far. Altogether, these top 10 users use about 23.8 million gallons of water a day on average. City leaders told the Gazette a Google data center would use two-thirds of the largest users. This could be as little as 200,000 gallons per day or as much as 7.8 million gallons based on the top 10 list. The city treats about 40 million gallons of water a day on average, but can increase that to 60 million gallons a day if needed. During some summer months, consumption can be about 65 million gallons a day. We are reserving capacity in case the developer completes all five potential data center buildings, said Dave Wallace, utilities engineering manager for the city. The development agreement requires a minimum of one data center building, which would require less water. The Meta Data Center complex in Altoona uses more water than Adventureland, an amusement and water park visited by 5,000 people a day in the summer. And when Meta, the parent company of social media sites Facebook and Instagram, opens two new buildings next year, it will surpass Prairie Meadows Casino and Racetrack and Marzetti Frozen Pasta to become Altoona's largest water consumer, consuming more than 300,000 gallons a day on average, Altoona Utilities Director Dan Scott said. Ultimately, Meta has the right to request up to 1 million gallons a day out of our total six, he said. The city of 22,000 near Des Moines is designating a fourth water treatment plant and digging two new wells, projects expected to cost $30 million together, to supply an additional 4 million gallons of water per day. Google paid to expand a water treatment plant in Council Bluffs to supply the water needs of two data centers the tech giant opened there in 2009 and 2013, according to an agreement obtained by the Gazette. When the expansion was complete in 2022, the Council Point Water Purification Plant could pump up to 10 million gallons per day, the Water Works reported in its 2022 annual report. Also from today's front page, raft of tornadoes flattens scores of Iowa homes. Several people injured as at least 10 twisters roar through the state, by Gazette staff and wires. At least 10 tornadoes ripped late Friday through western and central Iowa, flattening scores of homes and businesses and injuring several, and more storms are on the way for the state. Over 1,000 customers in western Iowa remained without power Saturday afternoon, including in Pottawatomie County, which suffered some of the storm's system's worst damage, according to an online utility tracker. Photos on social media showed heavy damage in the small town of Minden in Pottawatomie County, about 30 miles northeast of Omaha. The county declared a state of emergency and said at least four people had been injured and 120 homes and businesses were damaged, some of them outright destroyed. School buses were brought in to give residents a ride out of town if they needed one, said a briefing by Jeff Tulin, chief deputy of the sheriff's office there. He asked others to stay away from Minden area as it posed a danger from downed power lines and piles of debris where homes used to be. It's heartbreaking to see these people who've lost houses, cars, essentially their life until they have to rebuild it, Tulin said. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation for Pottawatomie County, which she said received significant damage from tornadoes, straight-line winds, hail, and flash flooding. The proclamation opens up state aid, including $5,000 grants for homeowners whose income qualifies. While the storms caused extensive damage in the Omaha area, reports to the National Weather Service revealed that the storms followed two main tracks as they crossed from Nebraska and Missouri into Iowa on northeasterly paths, one from the Omaha area stretching up to Soldier and one farther east through Winterset and the Des Moines metro area. Trained weather spotters and storm chasers reported a roof blown off an athletic training center in Stanton, east of Red Oak, cars flipped in Harlan, north of Red Oak, and a tornado at least a third of a mile wide in Minden. Near Des Moines, a tornado touched down Friday night in Pleasant Hill, causing one injury and damaging 20 homes, the Des Moines Register reported. Hundreds of houses were damaged Friday in Omaha, mostly in the western part of the city, Omaha Police Lieutenant Neil Bonacci said. Police and firefighters went door to door to help people. In one area of Omaha, dozens of newly built large homes were damaged. At least six were wrecked, including one that was leveled, while others had their top halves ripped off. The Weather Service dispatched teams Saturday to survey the extent of damage, but said it would be days before the teams were able to rate the strength of the tornadoes. However, radar data and damage indicators alike indicate the Omaha tornado system may have been a violent tornado corresponding to EF4 strength or greater on the 0 to 5 enhanced Fujita scale for twister intensity. Maximum winds probably approached or exceeded 170 miles per hour, though the final determination will be made by the Weather Service teams. The storms were part of a system that tore through parts of Nebraska and Iowa, with additional tornadoes reported in eastern Kansas and Missouri and near Waco, Texas. Worse, more storms were expected overnight Saturday and possibly into today. The worst of the storms expected later Saturday was expected to hit south of Iowa, where the Weather Service predicted long tail and severe tornadoes. The greatest potential for severe storms will be from north Texas into Oklahoma and southeast Kansas, where strong tornadoes, very large hail over 2 inches in diameter, and widespread damaging winds of over 70 miles per hour are expected to occur, the service warned. In eastern Iowa headed into today, Sunday, scattered showers and storms will persist, the Weather Service said. About a 90% of rain and thunderstorm was forecast today for Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. Hail and flash flooding near rivers and streams were possible. There is potential for this activity to become severe, the service's Quad City Bureau warned. Turning to the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state under the heading In the News, session ends with overnight sprint. Iowa lawmakers met for nearly 20 hours straight last weekend in a sprint to finish the 2024 legislative session. The last days of the session saw last-minute budget deals, a tax cut bill, and the breakdown of deals on issues like opioid treatment spending and extending the statewide casino moratorium. Republicans claimed a victory as the last gavel fell at 4:23 a.m. Saturday, touting their big and bold ideas and Iowa's transformation under Republican leadership. Democrats said the leading party failed to meet the needs of Iowans, instead serving special interests. Body of missing Iowa trucker found. The body of missing Wall Lake trucker David Schultz was found Wednesday afternoon in a Sac County field, not far from where his truck was discovered abandoned 5 months ago. The body was about a mile and a half away from the abandoned truck in an area where local law enforcement said they searched early into the investigation. Speech concerns drop at Iowa campuses. A growing number of students at Iowa's public universities say they feel comfortable expressing their opinions on and off campus, according to a second free speech survey conducted by the Board of Regents. The surveys follow pressure from Republican lawmakers after accusations of speech-suppressing incidents on campus. Iowa athletes file lawsuit. 26 current and former college student athletes, mostly from Iowa State University and the University of Iowa, are suing the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation based on allegations the agency violated their constitutional rights by doing a warrantless search that led to sports betting charges. The federal lawsuit filed Friday says DCI agents illegally used geofencing software to pinpoint online sports wagering by student athletes and search student athletes' phones without search warrants. Under the heading, They Said, Iowa has set a course for transformation and it was the driving force of the 2024 legislative session. Iowa is a state that values education, rewards hard work, and encourages strong families, a place where government is driven by a sense of responsibility to the people it serves. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds on the legislative session. And the things we introduced this legislative session were for everyday Iowans to help make their lives better, and Republicans chose politics and special interests. House Minority Leader Jennifer Confers, Democrat Windsor Heights on the legislative session. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Sheriff under investigation, Scott County Sheriff Tim Lane is being investigated by the Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board after a complaint alleged he violated the law by campaigning using patrol cars in a parade last year. Lane said the entry was not a campaign event and he denied any violations. DEI offices shutter. Iowa State and the University of Northern Iowa will close their diversity, equity, and inclusion offices after state lawmakers banned the universities from operating the offices outside limited circumstances. The University of Iowa is renaming its office to the Division of Access, Opportunity, and Diversity. Under the heading Water Cooler, India Mission, Governor Kim Reynolds will lead a trade mission to India in September focusing on agricultural and business partnerships. Reynolds will be accompanied by Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig and a delegation of agricultural and business leaders. Opioid funds unspent. Iowa state lawmakers ended this year's legislative session without deciding on how to spend more than $25 million in a fund meant for opioid addiction treatment and prevention. House and Senate Republicans disagreed over how much oversight was needed in use of the funds. Turning to the Insight page, there is a guest column from David V. Wendell. David V. Wendell is a Marion historian, author, and a special events coordinator specializing in American history. He writes, From Belknap to Mayorkas to Trump. An Iowan faced impeachment in 1876 even after he left office, setting a legal precedent. Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas is not the first member of a president's cabinet to be impeached. Almost 150 years ago, there was William W. Belknap. Belknap was born in upstate New York in 1829. After graduating from Princeton University, he moved to Keokuk and met future Iowa Governor Ralph Lowe. Together, they practiced law. In 1857, Belknap was elected to the Iowa House of Representatives. When the Civil War broke out in 1861, he enlisted with the 15th Iowa Infantry Regiment as a major. The 15th Iowa soldiers trained briefly at Keokuk, then boarded steamboats to Mississippi, where they marched into Tennessee and fought in the pivotal Battle of Shiloh. Belknap was wounded, but led his troops to help push the Confederate forces back to the city of Corinth, Mississippi. When it was determined the colonel for the 15th had been injured in the chaos of Shiloh, Belknap was placed in command of the unit. Pursuing the Confederate troops into Corinth, he rallied his soldiers there. Afterward, he was named provost marshal of the city, now under Union control. He was then promoted to brigadier general and placed at the head of an infantry division under the command of General William T. Sherman. They marched southeast into Georgia, and Belknap's troops fought to victory at Kennesaw Mountain. In the summer of 1864, he led his units to the outskirts of Atlanta to assist Sherman in capturing the capital of Georgia. By the end of the year, Sherman's forces had reached Savannah. 3 months after that, General Ulysses Grant had received the surrender of General Robert E. Lee in Virginia, and the war was over. Belknap returned to Keokuk and was named collector of revenue for the state's first district. 3 years later, Grant was elected president. He remembered Belknap's success at Shiloh so well that he appointed him to the position of Secretary of War in 1869. Belknap held the position until 1876. During that time, he and his wife hosted lavish parties at their home in Washington, D.C., near affluent Georgetown. As the position of Secretary of War paid only $8,000 a year, his political rivals were suspicious. When the rival Democratic Party won a majority in the House of Representatives, they began an investigation into Belknap's finances. Calling in witnesses, the investigating committee found evidence that Belknap had entered into a kickback scheme that had been bringing in substantial amounts of money since his first year in office. The allegation was that in 1870, he had entered into an agreement with a man who Belknap would name as a post trader at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, while that man awarded the duties to another man. The first would then forward $1,500 to Belknap, or his wife, every 3 months. This arrangement, having continued for 6 years, brought the Belknaps more than $24,000, or close to $700,000 in today's money. On March 2, 1876, the U.S. House was set to vote on whether to refer articles of impeachment to the Senate, but Belknap had submitted his resignation to President Grant that morning. The House members then questioned whether they should still send charges to the Senate, because it was unclear whether Congress could place a civilian on trial. The House debated the issue and on April 5th sent the 5 articles of impeachment to the Senate. The Senate, which held a slim Republican majority, along with 3 independents, was required by the Constitution to accept the articles and hold a trial. On the day the articles were formally received, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court swore in each member of the Senate for the proceedings. One of the first orders of business was to issue a summons for Belknap to appear in the Senate chamber. Belknap did not respond until the last possible day, on April 17th, avoiding additional charges of contempt of Congress. When his 3 attorneys were asked why Belknap did not answer the summons, they responded that he had no obligation to do so because he was a civilian, and the Senate had no authority to put him on trial. Therefore, when asked how did their client plea, they refused to answer one way or another. Senate members decided to interpret that as a plea of not guilty. Meanwhile, they also called for a vote on whether senators believed the Senate had a jurisdiction to host a trial. The vote was affirmative. With that setback, some of Belknap's associates tried another approach. Congress historically does not stay in Washington, D.C. during the hot summer season, so Senator William B. Allison of Dubuque submitted a motion to delay the trial until November. That also happened to be after the 1876 presidential election. The Senate voted down the motion and the trial resumed. 40 witnesses were brought to the stand, including the men with whom Belknap had allegedly entered into the illegal contract. Because the proceedings were held in what the senators termed secret session, there are no transcripts of exactly what was said. However, reports leaked that Mrs. Belknap, to satisfy her love of fashion, had allegedly encouraged and even collected some of the payments. The trial continued until August 1st, when it was agreed that a roll call would be made and each senator would respond yay or nay to every one of the 5 articles of impeachment. They would not be allowed to debate, but could also have 1 minute to explain their vote or submit their explanation in writing. After the final senator was called, the results showed that 25 had voted against conviction on each of the charges. As a 2/3 majority was needed in order to convict, in the case of the United States v. Belknap, Belknap was acquitted. Belknap's lawyers immediately trumpeted the results as a complete exoneration. The prosecution acknowledged they did not get a conviction, but said something far more important was achieved, creating the legal precedent that a civilian who had been a public officer still can be impeached and placed on trial for high crimes and misdemeanors. This is a precedent that has implications even in the 21st century, when Donald Trump's second impeachment trial was held after he left the presidency. Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, Biden administration rules snub girls Title IX meant to protect. There's an expression I heard often growing up, we're all girls. It's frequently stated in an organized setting among children and adolescents. I heard it in locker rooms, at summer camp, the bathhouse at the public pool, and school field trips, almost always during the uncomfortable moments when a group of us had to change clothes or shower in front of each other. We're all girls was what the women in charge of us said to ease our feelings of awkwardness and insecurity. It didn't erase them, but it was a reminder that during those brief moments when we didn't have privacy from each other, our privacy was still intact through each other. Every other body in that room with sensitive parts its person was hesitant to expose belonged to someone like us, another girl. That we were all girls was our comfort, and as long as it was all girls in the locker room, most of us felt safe in those moments of undress while we changed into and out of our swimsuits and gym clothes and band uniforms and dance costumes. Those moments and those feelings are part of every female's experience growing up. Female readers, you know this. Male readers, you have your own bathroom locker room culture. You know this. I unfortunately know this. My male friends told me stories. You're animals. Many of the moments and feelings that are part of the female experience growing up happen in a school setting. Over a half century ago, Title IX of the Education Amendments Act of 1972 was implemented in part to ensure that any federally funded education program did not discriminate against any person on the basis of sex. Most of us know Title IX as the policy that blazed a trail for girls' high school and collegiate sports long before female college superstars were selling out huge arenas and signing multi-million-dollar endorsement contracts. Many also know it extends well beyond girls' athletics. Title IX covers pretty much any area of the educational experience at a federally funded institution in which a student could face sex discrimination, from sexual harassment by a seventh grader to sexual assault on college campuses to being treated differently due to pregnancy or marital status. Its reach is vast and its legacy undeniable. But now, over a half century after its creation, the Biden administration has released new rules on enforcement of Title IX that fly in the face of the law's intent by widening the definition of sex and discrimination to include gender identity, thus rendering the definition of sex meaningless. With the stroke of a pen, a person's sex ceases to be the fixed and immutable physiological classification we know it to be. Instead, it becomes, well, whatever one wants or believes it to be. Though originally part of a single proposed change, the damage will come in two sections, each likely to be challenged in court. The original version of the proposed rule changes included sweeping requirements that would supersede any state laws prohibiting transgender students from playing on a sports team consistent with their gender identity. That includes Iowa's 2022 law limiting eligibility to girls' sports teams to the type of girls soon to be formally known as females. It also raises questions about whether college-level women's sports governing bodies would be forced to allow transgender players on women's teams. The rule regarding sports eligibility has been separated from the original proposed changes, and its implementation delayed, conveniently, until after the November election. That's likely not a coincidence. Let's be honest. Approval ratings, swing state polls, and voter enthusiasm indicate President Joe Biden's re-election is far from assured. Any pendulum effect from 2020 is gone, and not every voter who despises Trump is willing this time to opt for the guy who told a public audience recently that his uncle might have been eaten by cannibals in New Guinea. Clearly, it's better for the Biden campaign if the Biden administration holds off on the most politically damaging part of the Title IX changes. More than two-thirds of Americans, a growing number, believe transgender athletes should only be allowed to play for teams that match their sex. They will see such a change as an attack on women's sports just as they begin to reach unprecedented levels of popularity. The rest of the new Title IX rules don't get the punt. They're scheduled to take effect August 1st, and they could define a sex-based hostile environment that would constitute sexual harassment to be something as simple as declining to use a transgender student's chosen pronouns if it's deemed subjectively and objectively offensive to a student and to a person in the school community and rises to the level that it limits or denies access to education, according to an official with the Department of Education on an April 19th press call. That would also ensure that a transgender student would be entitled to use a restroom or locker room that corresponds with their gender identity and not their sex, undoing any state law or policy that assigns use of those facilities based on sex, including Iowa's 2023 law doing the same. The justification of allowing a trans student to choose their setting stems from the notion that forcing them to use restrooms and locker rooms in which they feel uncomfortable inflicts harm on them. Should a trans student with a male body opt to use the girls' locker room, there's no consideration for the female students who are uncomfortable, not even when that discomfort disrupts their own educational experience. How will the school accommodate those uncomfortable female students? When the Lynmar Community School District in Marion implemented its now-defunct gender identity policy in April 2022, the best the district was able and willing to offer was a curtain, a nearby restroom, someone's private office, or a separate changing schedule, suggesting that a trans student use the same accommodations if they were uncomfortable using facilities corresponding with their sex wasn't only impermissible, it was a cardinal sin. I don't believe that a gender nonconforming should be ignored in all this, nor do I pretend for a second to have the answers on how to accommodate a student who feels they need to dress in facilities created for the sex opposite theirs without forcing it on the other students who would be uncomfortable with it. But the policymakers in the Biden administration obviously don't have the answers either. What they fail to grasp is that these new regulations that will mandate that every public education institution in the U.S. allow students to use whatever restroom corresponds with their gendered identity will do nothing further to solve the problem. They only transfer the problem to a different and undoubtedly larger group, girls. When it's students with male bodies entering spaces previously reserved for females, it's those girls whose educational experience suffers, an experience shaped at the very same time by the happenings of the developing female body. Those can be downright terrifying. I know, I've been there. Every girl goes through it, only girls go through it, and only those of us with female bodies and female brains can understand it. A person with a male body can't understand the female experience of dreading gym class now that boys have started staring at her chest when she runs laps. A person with a male body can't understand a female's shock when she sees the blood and realizes she's menstruating for the first time. They can't understand what the cramps feel like. They have no idea how messy it can be to insert or change a tampon. A person with a male body can't understand how personally objectifying it feels when it dawns on a girl that almost all of the mature content in movies and television is of women's bodies. A person with a male body can't understand how mortifying it is when a girl stands up at the end of class and feels the blood gushing between her legs, or how nervous she feels while she stuffs a big wad of toilet paper in her underwear, hoping it will last until she gets off the bus. They've never had a friend walk up behind them urgently and whisper to them, "I think you're having an accident." They can't know what it feels like for a female to tie a jacket around her waist to cover her behind and hold her backpack to cover her front. If any of that made you uncomfortable, you're probably male. Turning to the community letters and the editorial cartoon from editorial cartoonist Joe Heller, who is based in Green Bay, it's labeled Weapons Aid Bill Passed, and there is a series of four increasingly larger missiles. The first and smallest missile says to Taiwan. The next slightly larger missile says to Israel. The third and larger missile says to Ukraine. And the largest missile says to TikTok, sell or die. The first letter is from Eric Johnson of Oxford. Plug-in hybrid electric vehicles are affordable for a greener future. Electric vehicles are the future of transit, but their high cost is a hurdle for many. Plug-in hybrid electric vehicles offer a cost-effective alternative during this transition. PHEVs blend a gasoline engine with an electric motor, enabling electric power for daily commutes and gasoline for longer journeys. This dual functionality reduces range anxiety, lowers daily fuel costs and emissions, and is generally more affordable than full EVs, making them accessible to a wider consumer base. PHEVs aren't limited by sparse charging infrastructure, a common obstacle for full EV adoption. They can be recharged at home using standard outlets, adding convenience. For example, a 2016 Chevy Volt has 55 miles of electric range and 450 miles of total range. This electric range covers most miles driven by Americans. With Alliance Nights and Weekends program, charging at home costs $18 compared with $76 at the pump. The 2016 Volt's current price is $13,000. PHEVs are a bridge technology toward a greener future, offering immediate environmental benefits, practical usability, and an economical entry to electrified transportation, all vital for a fully electric future. Eric Johnson of Oxford. Rebecca Burgess of Iowa City writes, Miller Meeks and staff are never available. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks should be my voice in Congress, but I don't see how she can be, since she doesn't care about what I care about. She doesn't know what I care about. Each fall, I join other Iowans in Washington, D.C. to meet with our elected officials. Representative Miller Meeks has never met with us. On three occasions, we have had appointments with someone on her staff, only to have them canceled on short notice. I've emailed her through her website. Her form gives me option to request a response, which I do. I've yet to receive a response from Representative Miller Meeks. This is very different from my experience with our senators. They, or someone on their staff, meets with us when we are in Washington, D.C., or at their offices in Cedar Rapids. When writing to Senators Chuck Grassley or Joni Ernst, I get a reply to my specific concerns. They may not agree with me, but they explain their position and reasons. In the next election, I will look for a candidate who is willing to listen to the people in District 1. Rebecca Burgess of Iowa City. The next letter is from Martin Smith of Cedar Rapids. Iowans shortchanged by state tax cuts. The governor has declared and the legislature has agreed that the state surplus represents having collected too much in taxes and that should be returned to the people by cutting income taxes, somehow skewed heavily to go to her campaign donors and rich people. My view is that the surplus represents services that the people have paid for, but the governor and legislature decided should be shortchanged or not delivered at all. A few items from that list. Public school funding has increased less than inflation for several years. Mental health facilities closed, forcing families to have to travel farther to receive services and reducing the availability of inpatient services. Corrections funding shortchanged, increasing dangers to staff and inmates at prisons and overloading parole officers. State parks are underfunded, resulting in inadequate maintenance, and the deferred maintenance at ranger residences now has become the excuse to force rangers out of ranger residences in the parks, which will increase response times when they are needed. They choose to remove funding for measuring water quality so that they can lie about the abysmal water quality in Iowa's lakes and streams with little fear that anyone will quote actual measurements to contradict their claims. These are a few of the things Iowans have paid for, but Republicans have decided Iowans don't deserve to get. The theft was not the tax collection. The theft is in the refusal to deliver the services. Sending bigger tax cuts to a favored few aggravates the malfeasance. Martin Smith of Cedar Rapids. Next, Stephen Carfrey of Cedar Rapids writes, honoring women's World War II efforts past due. During World War II, women took on jobs that were held by men who went off to war. This group of women were known collectively as Rosie the Riveter. They built tanks, ships, planes, munitions, and worked in many other areas that helped the war effort. On April 10th, a group of Rosies received the Congressional Gold Medal in Washington, D.C. Unfortunately, many Rosies have passed away, not knowing that their country recognized their effort during the war. It took almost 80 years for Congress to pass the Rosie the Riveter Congressional Gold Medal Act, which was signed into law in December 2020. I have just one question for Congress. What took you so long? Stephen Carfrey of Cedar Rapids. And Sharon Feltudo of Coralville writes, remember action on guns in school this November. It's good practice to ask before your child plays at a friend's house if that household has guns in it. If so, are they securely stored? The Iowa legislature has decided that not only can Iowa teachers and school staff carry guns, they are not required to disclose that they are carrying. Sometime in the next school year, a student or teacher is going to be seriously wounded or worse by a gun either accidentally or intentionally being fired. Please remember this nonsense, as well as the legislature's other plans to destroy public schools in Iowa, such as private school vouchers and gutting the area education agencies, when you vote in November. Sharon Feltudo of Coralville. And some quotes of the week. The first, from Save CR Heritage Board of Directors opposing the demolition of the Ambrose Building approved by the City Council. The Board of Directors says, the proposal on your agenda would send the historic school to the landfill and build a generic four-story complex in the middle of this more than century-old neighborhood. Next, Kelsey Sutter of the Iowa Pork Producers, which is searching for the best breaded tenderloin in Iowa, says, Iowans love their tenderloin sandwiches and there is no shortage of restaurants serving up these beloved Iowa staples. Next, Representative Phil Thompson, Republican Boone, speaking in support of allowing school staff to carry firearms. Time and math do not lie. The first 30 seconds in these scenarios are extremely critical. This bill does set a high standard for districts and staff that want to participate in this and go the extra mile to protect our kids. Next, Cedar Rapids City Council member Dale Todd reflecting on his friend and community leader Bill Quinby, who died at the age of 92. I've often asked myself, what would Quinby do? He was our moral compass. And Hawkeye women's basketball player Addison O'Grady, who is among athletes assigned to create pet housing of the Domestic Violence Intervention Program, said, we really like interacting with our community, and our community really appreciates us coming out. Especially after this season, we're just giving back to all the fans who gave so much to us. You were listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 28, 2024, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Feltudo, and we turn to today's obituaries. Earl Fick, known as Dean of Marion, age 79, passed away Friday, April 19th at St. Luke's Hospice. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, May 3rd at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. The memorial service will begin at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, May 4th at the Lutheran Church of Resurrection in Marion, with additional visitation 1 hour prior. Reverend Jeff Froner will officiate. Interment at Holstein Cemetery in Holstein, Iowa at a later date. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion assisting the family. Dean worked for Grinnell Mutual Reinsurance, then retired as Vice President of Claims at United Fire and Casualty. He was a member of the Lutheran Church of the Resurrection. He enjoyed golfing with his Tuesday golf game buddies and was fortunate to take a trip to Scotland with his son Tony to play golf. Over the years, he played many courses with his wife throughout the United States. Gail Judith Kolda, born Gail Judith Kettler of Westerville, Ohio, passed away peacefully on April 18th at Mount Carmel St. Anne's Hospital in Westerville, Ohio. James August Beck, known as Jim, age 84, of Marion, passed away April 24th at Woodland Creek Senior Living in Clive, Iowa. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, May 4th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, with a visitation 1 hour prior to the mass. Burial with military honors will follow at Oakshade Cemetery in Marion. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. He served his country honorably in the United States Air Force. Jim worked for Rockwell Collins for over 30 years before his retirement in 1996. Jim was a very faithful man who found great joy serving as Eucharistic minister at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, where he would visit the homebound and tutored grade school students at St. Joseph Catholic School. He also ministered Christ to prisoners in Anamosa. He was a former member of Immaculate Conception in Cedar Rapids, Indian Creek Country Club, and the American Legion Post 298. Jim made an impact on everyone he met, enjoyed volunteering his time, and won the KCRG 9 Who Care Award. He was an avid Hawkeye and Green Bay Packers fan. Charles Edward Lane, age 82, of Manchester, went to meet his Lord and Savior on April 21st at the Regional Medical Center in Manchester. Charles entered the United States Marine Corps. He served in the readiness unit that would, at a moment's notice, board naval ships where they would be sent to Okinawa, Philippines, Japan, and China. He was later employed as machinist at Cherry Burrell, now Cedar Rapids International Paper, retiring in 2000. After a time, he was employed at the West Delaware Middle School doing custodial work and enjoying being with the staff and student for 10 years, retiring in 2014. Charles was a member of the Stone Church, formerly First Baptist Church. He served in various capacities over the last 60 years. He considered everyone he met a friend. He enjoyed reading the Bible, Western movies and music, family celebrations, watching wrestling meets, as he was a wrestler in high school, and in the Marine Corps. And he loved making his famous chili and delicious Christmas candy. Memorial service with military honors, 11 a.m. Saturday, May 4th at Stone Church in Manchester, with Pastor Mark Moyer officiating. Visitation, 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, May 4th at Stone Church in Manchester. Eldine Jane Lenth, age 86, of Cedar Rapids, peacefully passed April 23rd. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life will take place at 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 1st, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories by the Reverend Craig Brown from First Lutheran Church, where Eldine and her husband were members for years. Burial, Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. A light lunch will be served after the service in the Family Center at Cedar Memorial. Eldine worked in banking for over 26 years while also enjoying at her children's schools, church activities, and neighborhood get-togethers such as bridge groups and block parties. She always looked forward to being together as a family to go bowling, playing an intense game of train dominoes, or cheering on our Cyclones as well as the Hawkeyes and Panthers. She was spunky, always up to try new things, and funnier than she realized. People always loved her smile. Peggy Joyce Leff, age 91, of Iowa City, dies peacefully on March 26th at her home, surrounded by family. An open house celebrating the life of Joyce will be held on Sunday, May 26th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. at their family home, 12 Lakeview Drive Northeast in Iowa City. Charles Lee Davis, age 87, of Schillsburg, passed away March 29th at Hemphill Hospice Unit at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids due to Alzheimer's. Services will be held at Murdoch Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, April 30th at 11 a.m. with a visitation time with family starting at 10 a.m. All are invited to fellowship and lunch after the service. Michael James Christensen, age 71, of Brooklyn, Iowa, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 21st at his home. A visitation will be held from 10 to 11:30 a.m. Monday, April 29th at Murdoch Glenwood Funeral and Cremation in Cedar Rapids. Funeral service will immediately follow the visitation at 11:30 a.m. at the funeral home. Michael dedicated his life to education and retired as a professor of computer science from Blackhawk Community College. Michael enjoyed cooking, video games, learning Spanish, and spending time in nature, especially bird watching. Carol Husted, age 79, of Marion, passed away peacefully at her home on April 25th. Visitation, 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, April 29th, at Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service, Cedar Rapids. Funeral service, 10 a.m. Tuesday, April 30th, at Christ Community United Methodist Church in Marion. Burial will follow at Troy Mills Cemetery with a luncheon following at the church. Those who knew Carol would describe her as a busy bee. She was a member of the Christ United Methodist Church in Marion. She was also a member of the ABWA, NAWIC, Eagles Club, Moose Club, and Home Builders Association. Carol was also the owner of A1 Siding, Windows, and More for 37 years. In 2004, Carol traveled to the White House to receive the Women Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Alan Dwayne Hammon, age 77, of Cedar Rapids, passed into eternal life and peace on Monday, April 22nd. Al served in the U.S. Navy and was a veteran of the Vietnam War. He was an avid sportsman who passed along his love for hunting, fishing, and the outdoors. John F. O'Connor, age 77, of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 24th at the University of Iowa Hospital in Iowa City. Visitation, 4 to 7, Tuesday, April 30th, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Memorial service, 10 a.m. Wednesday, May 1st, at the funeral home. John worked for FMC and Universal Engineering before retiring in 2017. He was a very active 45-year member of the Elks Lodge 251 in Cedar Rapids, where he and his wife hosted the special needs prom dance for 36 years, which has been named in their honor. A. James Tinker, known as Jim of Cedar Rapids, passed away April 21st after a heroic battle against MDS. Jim moved to Cedar Rapids in 1982 to begin his career at Mercy Medical Center as president and chief executive officer. Through his leadership, Mercy became the fourth largest employer in Cedar Rapids, encompassing over 1 million square feet of space with an operating budget of over $150 million. After joining the Mercy family, Jim grew the operation from $30.5 million to over $328.4 million in assets, all in effort to bring exceptional health care to the region. Additionally, under Jim's tenure, Mercy Medical Center was recognized as a top 100 orthopedic hospital. As a visionary, Jim saw the need to provide care when people were not able to see their own doctor. In 1983, he established an urgent care clinic known as Mercy Care North. In 2007, Jim chose to retire and give more attention to more personal pursuits and passions. Travel was a favorite. There will be a private funeral service to celebrate Jim's life at the Tinker Family Cemetery in Butler, Pennsylvania. Donald Earl Bach, known as Don, age 86, of Center Point, passed away April 23rd at the Views in Marion after a long illness. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, May 2nd, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, located at 3855 Katz Drive in Marion, where the family will greet friends from 1 p.m. until the service. Interment will follow at Alice Cemetery, located at 4617 Alice Road in Center Point. Don's professional journey started as a purchasing agent for Rockwell Collins and later founded Bach Miller Construction, Inc., where he served as president from 1978 until the company was sold in 1993. Don then found his true passion in helping others, which he pursued as the general manager of Sedona Staffing Services in Cedar Rapids. Don retired in 2006, leaving behind a legacy of hard work and dedication. Don and his wife Dorothy belonged to Radiant Church, formerly First Assembly of God in Cedar Rapids. They greeted others at the front doors every Sunday for many years. They also led the primetime ministry and hosted many Bible studies and life groups in their home. Don also loved to support and volunteer when the Convoy of Hope came to town. Leroy Gerd Rickles, known as Leroy, of Monticello, age 92, died peacefully in his home April 24th. Leroy enlisted in the United States Army in 1952. After returning from the Army, he spent brief time in Bellevue, Iowa, where Leroy was a police officer, before he returned to Monticello, where he and his wife purchased their farm. This was the start of Leroy's passion for crop farming and milking dairy cows. He loved the land and all that it offered and was most at home in timber doing what he loved, cutting wood, picking berries and grapes, for which he made homemade wine. Leroy enjoyed the outdoors, hunting turkey, deer, and coon. His favorite hunting was for the elusive morel mushroom in the spring. To honor Leroy's wishes, there will be a private graveside service. John Paul Benda, age 80, passed away at April 17th at his home in Clive, Iowa. Memorial services will be held 11 a.m. Monday, July 8th at Sacred Heart Catholic Church in West Des Moines, with visitation from 10 a.m. until service time at the church. Burial will be at Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Adel. John Marvin Wilson, known as Shorty, age 89, of Zionsville, Indiana, died on March 21st after a short illness. Despite playing in the era before the shot clock and the three-point shot, he is still listed as one of the all-time leading scorers in Iowa high school basketball history. John worked in many capacities, including loan officer and branch manager for United California Bank, which became First Interstate Bank and later merged with Wells Fargo. He retired as a senior vice president in the commercial loan department. In his later years at the bank, he was known by his younger co-workers as the Big Dog. He remained a lifelong sports fan, especially of the Iowa Hawkeyes. This led to several fun, memorable, yet unfortunate family trips to the Rose Bowl parade and game. A private graveside service will be held in Van Horn, Iowa, on May 3rd. Catherine Pavlis Porter of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Born in Cedar Rapids, Kathy had an active and loving childhood in Cedar Rapids, attending camp and loving family, the wide circle of friends. She exhibited a talent for art at a young age and took private lessons and had the support and encouragement of her high school art teachers. Kathy suffered a heart attack and could not recover from the damage. She died peacefully at home on April 22nd, surrounded by family and friends. Ronald Clifford McGraw of Cedar Rapids passed away on April 19th at the age of 97. A celebration of Ron's life will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories on Saturday, June 1st, 2 p.m., with a reception following at the Cedar Memorial Family Center and Library. Ron was drafted into the U.S. Army through a series of events, including a troop transport ship breaking down in the Pacific. World War II ended before he was ever deployed in theater. Ron then served with occupation forces in Korea as a medic, which resulted in many memorable experiences. In retrospect, he would say, "I got more from the Army than the Army got from me." Ron joined Collins Radio, later Rockwell Collins, in 1951 and was employed there until 1992. Ron had a distinguished career, starting in UHF radio engineering, then program management, which included leading industry firsts like the AINS-70 area navigation system, the color cockpit displays on the Boeing 757-6067, and finally as vice president for railroad electronics. His business travels took him to China, Australia, and Europe. After retiring from Rockwell Collins, Ron started a second career as a busy volunteer. He led trail planning efforts with the Linn County Trails Association for many years and spent many hours working with officials from local area governments and the state DOT. Ron's groundwork helped make many of the trails we enjoy in the Cedar Rapids area today a reality. Ron and his wife were longtime members of the People's Church Unitarian Universalist, and he served in multiple capacities, notably as treasurer for many years. Jean Stammy Sobeck, age 99, of Westfield, Indiana, passed away April 24th, 2024. After college, Jean was employed by IBM until her marriage, when women could not be employed. Jean and Joe became residents of Hammond and Munster, Indiana, when their children were born and raised. Burial will be at a later date in Hammond. Linda Jane Spratt, age 80, of Marion, was called home to heaven on April 21st after a short battle with ovarian cancer. God was merciful, and she passed away in her sleep. A visitation will be held at 9:30 a.m. Monday, April 29th at St. Bias Ex-Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids, followed by a Mass at 10:30. Burial immediately following at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Murdoch Funeral Home Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Linda was employed by the Cedar Rapids Post Office for 30 years before retiring in 2009. She was an avid Iowa Hawkeyes fan and shared her love of 60s music, especially the Beatles, with her sister. Linda enjoyed reading and in her younger years loved biking on the trails. She also loved cats her entire life. Linda was a devout Catholic and attended service regularly. Turning to the sports page in the Drake Relays, close to his heart, late burst gives Iowa City West Jacobson the 400 hurdles flag by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. Aiden Jacobson never met his late grandfather, but when Aiden competes, a piece of Dean Jacobson, his wedding band to be precise, comes along for the ride. It was a voyage of victory Saturday afternoon. Jacobson emerged from a four-wide deadlock in the final 40 meters and claimed the Drake Relays Boys 400-meter hurdles championship at Drake Stadium. A senior at Iowa City West and recently committed Iowa State University recruit, Jacobson, 52.03 seconds, edged Mount Airs Rice Reynolds, 52.09. "I'm just really, really happy," Jacobson said. "It's kind of different going out there as the favorite, but I feel like I'm the favorite every time I get on the track." Jacobson's efforts ranks number 10 all-time in Iowa. He wasn't the fastest one out of the blocks, and he still had some ground to make up at the race's midpoint. "Some of the other guys got out really fast," Jacobson said, "but my best stretch is the back curve, and I thought I had another gear coming down to the end." After grabbing his championship flag, Jacobson shared a moment and an embrace with his father, Ryan Jacobson. It was Ryan who passed along Dean's ring, intertwined in a silver chain around Aiden's neck. Dean passed away in 2001, 5 years before Aiden was born. Western Dubuque qualified fourth in the boys' shuttle hurdle relay, then upgraded to second in the finals. The Bobcats crew of Brandon Decker, Jaden Thin, and Tyler Horseman, Ashton Hogue, was clocked at 58.41 seconds. Cedar Falls won in 57.89. "Some people might have thought that we were a fraud, even though we were number one in the state coming into Drake," said Hogue Frith, who moved the Bobcats up two spots in his anchor leg. This shows that Western Dubuque can compete. This is a good look going into the state meet because we destroyed the rest of our Class 3A competition. Worsman said the finals felt a lot better than the prelims. We were all locked in. Ankeny set a Drake record in the 3,200-meter relay in 7:39.54. The meet was delayed at 4:14 p.m. due to severe weather in the area, with three events yet to be run: the 400-meter relay, the 1,600-meter run, and the 1,600-meter relay. And Trojan hurdlers finished third. In women's high school girls, West set aside banana suits in time for Drake by Jeff Linder of the Gazette. In Des Moines, they were virtually unrecognizable. Gone, at least for this weekend, were Iowa City West's trademark bright yellow girls' track and field uniforms, banana suits coined by some. In their place, all black. "We just got these in time for Drake," Jalen Herring said. There was some speed in these new duds Saturday. Aaron Varga, Herring, Araniah Carter, Sophia Olivo ran to third place in the Drake Relay's girls' shuttle hurdle relay at Drake Stadium. The Trojans finished in 1 minute, 4.87 seconds. West Des Moines Dowling won in 101.43, followed by Adele ADM, 104.86, then West. "I'm pretty happy that I caught one," said Olivo, who very nearly caught another. Herring said she felt I could have run a better leg. "I got too close to the first hurdle, then I couldn't three-step because I was too close." That third-place finish was the second best of any area girls' competitor all weekend. Mount Vernon's Sydney Mao was the high jump runner-up Thursday. The meet was delayed at 4:14 p.m. due to severe weather in the area, with three events yet to be run: 400-meter relay, 1,600-meter run, and the 1,600-meter relay. Pleasant Valley set a Drake Relay's record and an all-time Iowa best in the 3,200-meter relay, running away with it in 9:01.47. The previous mark of 9:09.09, set by Iowa City West, had stood for 23 years. And we have the history happenings column from Jessica Klein and Rob Klein. Jessica Klein, a leadership and character scholar at Wake Forest University, and her dad, Rob Klein, not a scholar of any kind, who write this monthly column for the History Center. Riverboats, steamers of big tonnage once plied Cedar and Iowa rivers. To the average citizen of the Cedar Rapids of today, the statement will come as a revelation that the time has been when the Cedar River was a navigable stream, that there was transportation by water from St. Louis via the Mississippi, Iowa, and Cedar Rivers, and that steamers of big tonnage and heavy horsepower traversed the waters between St. Louis, Missouri, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The diction of the above quote aside, it probably could appear in the Gazette today and still be true. Certainly, the average citizens who write this column were surprised to learn that steamers of big tonnage and heavy horsepower were once seen regularly in the Cedar River. The article from which our opening quote was taken appeared in the Cedar Rapids Evening Gazette on Saturday, January 31st, 1903. It was titled "Early Steamboating on the Cedar River," and the article's subhead made it clear that the article was looking back toward days of yore. Some interesting reminiscences related by an old-time pilot, Willis Vance, days when big boats landed here. In his reminiscences, Vance described a boat known as the Black Hawk, where he got his first experience navigating the Cedar River in 1858, after arriving in Cedar Rapids a decade before aboard the Uncle Toby. As the Black Hawk's name suggests, it was built to accommodate trade between Cedar Rapids and Waterloo, the latter, of course, being located in Black Hawk County. The county came into being in 1843. We should note that the boat originally was christened the Exportin in 1858. It was built for a company organized by George Green, one of Cedar Rapids' founding figures, and built by the Freeman Smith Company from lumber sawed by Snofer and Watrous in Beaver Park. The boat, eventually known as the Black Hawk, had a 13-foot beam and was 114 feet in length. There was a single deck, so the boat was short enough to run under a wagon bridge across the Cedar River at Vinton. 30 to 40 passengers could ride in the boat's cabin, and another 200 could be crowded on the deck. The boat's tonnage was 125, and a locomotive tubular boiler, consisting of 49 flues, provided steam for a 100-horsepower engine. According to the article, the Black Hawk could make three or four round trips per week between Cedar Rapids and Waterloo, depending on water levels. Pilot Vance said that navigation of the Cedar north of here was accompanied often by many delays and vexations. A sandbar, for example, could cause a delay of several hours. There were no other boats to give the signal of distress to, so the Black Hawk had to back off, spar over the low places, shift the freight from one side to the other, and get out of shallow water the best way she could. The boat ran at night when traveling toward Waterloo, but not on the return trip due to the river's current. The Evening Gazette article concluded, "Steamboat traffic on the Cedar is now but a memory. It scarcely seems as we view the shallow stream of today that it could have been, but it was." Our research, aided by Pete Looney, author of Lost Cedar Rapids, and the Gazette's Mary Sharp, turned up a number of other boats that once plied the Cedar River. These include an excursion boat known as the Carrie Wallace, which the Cedar Rapids Times called out in its mere mention column in 1879. The Parlor City, which Thomas Kelty, a former saloon owner, who appears to have been something of a rabble-rouser, purchased in 1899, and the Kappa Ann, which an organization known as Youth Council purchased in 1967. The Kappa Ann was the site of dances on Saturday nights and boasted a coffee house and snack bar on Wednesday nights. According to a feature in the Sunday, July 16, 1967 edition of the Gazette, the 75 Youth Council members organized the functions on the boat, which were always chaperoned by parents of the members. Any high school student in the area may join the Kappa Ann Club in order to attend the events on the boat. We would love to hear from anyone who has memories of the Kappa Ann. If you have a story to share, please write to us at historicalclines@gmail.com. Kline is spelled C-L-I-N-E. Before we go, a quick correction to our March column. Manes A. Hagen, author of The Worldly Game, The Story of Baseball in the Emea Colonies, is female. An editor mistakenly called her a male. We apologize and recommend her book, A Delight for Baseball Fans. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, April 28th, 2024. I have been your reader, Sharon Falduto, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We do welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.